Thank you very much, Sarah, and thank you everyone for coming out on a night like this, and thank you all of those there out on Zoom land, maybe some of my IB students that were at my first lecture at the school are there. Hello to you. Bonjour. Soyez les bienvenus ce soir. And whoever else might be around. Okay, so I'm going to ease you into this lecture because the first one was the God Killer, and this one is the Christ Denier. And I'm glad I added notorious, lest you believe that Nietzsche actually believes that which he doesn't. But that's what he is accused of. So the first little part of the lecture will be to ease you back into the material, to reassure you that it's available on the Benedictus site for you to listen to, the first lecture, and also the notes. And the same will happen with tonight's lecture. It also will be recorded and is being recorded, and also you will have access to the notes as well. And to my IB students, I say, or my, should I say, those who have invited me to come to speak to them, I will certainly make them available to you as well. So, as you know from the series, it's meant to introduce Nietzsche in a fresh way to those readers familiar with his writings, those new to them, but wanting to know more, and to scholars curious about a different way of reading him. My desire is to dispel the misconceptions which perpetuate the myth of his notoriety, and finally to provide, through his theology of suspicion, exciting ways of approaching religion and life into an AI-dominated 21st and 22nd century. So you can say I'm a bit like one of those writers who are looking for sequels, you know, later on, but not really. The Life Affirmer, which is my third lecture before the end of this year, will open things up for you in terms of where that's going into the future. So last lecture, for those joining us for the first time, in alignment with our aims to introduce Nietzsche in a fresh way, my purpose all along will continue to be to dispel misconceptions about Nietzsche's attitude to God, his attitude to Christ and to life. Popularly, he is thought of as saying and wanting us to believe that God is dead, and more that modernity is responsible for killing off God altogether. In the last lecture, we saw in some detail that this was not the case. Rather, it was the madman in Nietzsche's parable, in his book, The Gay Science, and not Nietzsche who declared not only that God was dead, but that those in the marketplace who were scorning the madman about the fact that God is mostly absent rather than present, and did he perhaps get lost, or where was he, and why was he invisible, if not all of the time? He turned to them and said, "You have murdered him." And not just them, but implied that all of us are complicit in the murder of God. When we ask what Nietzsche actually thought about God, or the God question, his answer betrays not just a sense that belief in the Christian God had become unbelievable, but that a deep darkness of doubt had already begun to descend over the world, beginning with his beloved cosmopolitan Europe. He writes, "The belief in the Christian God has become unbelievable, is already starting to cast its first shadow over Europe. Some kind of sun seems to have set. Some old deep trust has turned into doubt. The world has become autumnal, most mistrustful, stranger, older." Paradoxically, the sense of impending doom is balanced by Nietzsche in his book, The Gay Science. You can tell from the title, he's not glum about it all. Balanced by hope from which great expectations may yet be born. Homage to Charles Dickens. He writes, "Indeed, at hearing the news that the old God is dead, we philosophers and free spirits feel illuminated by a new dawn. Our heart overflows with gratitude, amazement. Finally, the horizon seems clear enough, even if not bright, Finally, our ships may set out again, set face to any danger. The sea, our sea, lies open again. Maybe there has never been such an open sea. Isn't that beautiful? That's why I say to you, those of you that haven't come across Nietzsche before, you know, you're expecting this rather desultory, dispassionate, detached lecture. Well, forget it, because Nietzsche was never like that. And really, I wish I could say this to people before they come to any lecture, is to understand that Nietzsche is very personable, very real. He's there to be accessible, not inaccessible. He's playful. He's humorous, unlike some of our academics who possibly have lost their sense of humour somewhere along the line, and I don't even know that there is a sea out there to be launched out into, thinking that they know it all, which of course they don't, because 5% is all we know about dark matter and dark energy. So I think a little bit of humility on the part of philosophers is probably a good thing, and I think Nietzsche was always aware of that, having become one of the youngest professors of philosophy, well, not philosophy, but of philology in Switzerland. He soon began to realise that that's what academia is, and he didn't want too much part of it. But, you know, despite that, despite all the academics sort of, rolling their eyes and so on, he's the name that stands out, and all the other lecturers, they're all forgotten, you know. So keep that in mind as you continue to come with me on this journey. So more than an inference, Nietzsche is saying that the old gods who have died were ipso facto, that is by their very nature, dead from the beginning. And more, that the whole idea of a dead or murdered God is a non sequitur, a nonsense, a stupidity, because God, if there is a God, could never die, and of necessity could never be killed. It is here that Nietzsche's madman has the last laugh on those academics who spill litres of ink reading Nietzsche literally, unerringly guided by their reductionist, fundamentalist, and ultimately simplistic cherry-picking. Such an approach misses the playfulness and the irony of the Roman and Greek satirical style which Nietzsche deploys. Uncertain about how to react to the satire's hyperbole, those with Christian presuppositions are mostly offended. But those who are disinterested in religion deliberately ignore or misunderstand Nietzsche's deep interest in Greek tragedy, Dionysus, and the crucified, and the connotations that come with these. Still convinced that his perceived atheism precludes any such religious discussion or interest. So you can see that he divides people, and people are kind of all squabbling among themselves, trying to work out where they belong. A bit like, Mab? In Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, I didn't know where to have her, or something, is the line that comes back to me in my terrible Year 8 Shakespeare days. And I don't know that I quite understood what that meant then, but I think I do now, and I hope I haven't offended anyone in bringing that up. In sum, I introduced you to a Nietzsche quite different from the one paraded by many as indifferent to religion, indifferent to our feelings, hell-bent on sabotaging people's faith. What we see from his correspondence is a person sensitive to his friends, and you are, would be his friends, sensitive to their discomfiture, but nevertheless possessed of a strong commitment to what is real and what is true. Okay, he will have nothing of pretense or make-believe. He writes, "I see and feel my friend's distress." Philosophers don't talk this way, do they? "Which mirror my own." Oh. We're meeting heart to heart, feeling to feeling, mind to mind. "My time to recall and reflect on myself was terrifying, in a way." How many philosophers feel terrified by their thinking? Which probably means that they're not really thinking, otherwise they probably would be terrified. He says, "I saw myself utterly emaciated, utterly starved. My science hitherto had excluded my realities and my true aspirations. I realize soon I shall have to express ideas which people regard as disgraceful, Even my friends and relations will become shy and frightened. And then he adds this, yet I must pass through that fire. If I'm going to go through it, you're going to go through it. I bring to my thinking and my lecturing who I am. You bring yourselves as listeners to the lectures. And together we feel these ideas together. Nietzsche always said, if you don't feel the idea, if you don't stand under the idea and allow the full weight of the problem to bear upon you, you haven't understood that idea. You haven't even begun to get in, off the shallows into the deep water that he's inviting us to go into. Thus Nietzsche comes across as a person honouring friendship, but also feels compelled to honour life as it is, rather than an imagined or idealized one. He writes again with his friends in mind, I'm quietly waiting for the waves in which my poor friends are floundering to die down. If I push them into these waves, life is not in danger. I know that from experience. And if here and there friendship might be in danger, then we will serve the truth together, as it were, and say, as yet, we have loved only a cloud of one another. It's a beautiful expression, isn't it? And how many of us go through the entire lives seeing our neighbours as a cloud? People dying in their flats, not being found until 3 months later. In other words, Nietzsche is not a Schopenhauerian nihilist. He's always presented as a nihilist, doesn't believe in anything. He's killed God, he wants to kill our faith, he wants to kill everything that's sacred to us. No. But he's a person who savours each moment, inspired by visions of mountains, the moon, the sea, the season of spring and of love, determined to acknowledge them all, valorise and embrace them as they are, not suppressing the moment, but living each day to the full. Do you see? I've introduced you to Nietzsche, and you're not frightened now, because he's told you you might be frightened, but you don't need to be, because there's more here. So he says, life consists of rare individual moments. How many philosophers do you know that think about living in the moment? That's why I know he's a mystic, because that's what mystics do. They live in the moment. In the individual moments of the highest significance. Each moment is important. This moment that we're enjoying together on Zoom and here is significant, highly significant, more significant than any of us imagine. They all speak truly to our heart only once, these moments, if they ever do truly find speech. For many people never experience these moments at all, but are themselves only intervals and pauses in the symphony of real life. Nor do we find cynicism in Nietzsche. On this perfect day, he writes, when everything is ripening, and not only the grape turns brown, the eye of the sun just fell upon my life. I look forward, I look backward, and never saw so many good things at once. I do not want to wage war against what is ugly. I don't want to accuse those who accuse. Looking away shall be my only negation. Someday, I wish to be only a yes-sayer. Now, how many philosophers would say that to you? Right? The philosophers who have studied him over many years always say that, that when you read Nietzsche, you can't read him intellectually up here. You have to read him. You know, he disturbs you by reading you, almost speaking the language that you understand. In fact, we've almost convinced ourselves that philosophy is more comfortable if we don't understand it, you know. But then, of course, there's the obverse side of that. When you really do understand what he's saying, you also get a bit of a fright as well. But then it's a good fright. Yes, he is one who, far from deriding faith and values, urges us to carefully consider the implications of what we have done when we set truth and faith aside. Throw the baby out with the bathwater. If there are any Year 12 students there, some, you know that some Year 12 students didn't actually know what that meant. I had to explain it to them. they thought that you know, the social work people should be rung, you know. And he says, what were we doing when we unchanged this earth from its sun? Where is it moving to? Where are we moving to? Away from all suns? Drawing attention here, as he does, to the vacuum, the disorientation which the ditching of all faith has created. He was aware of that in the 19th century, and we're now very much in the throes of it, almost the completion of this movement that he sensed almost 150 years ago. Are we continually falling, he asks? Backwards, sideways, forwards, in all directions? Is there still an up and down? Do we even know what up is and what down is anymore in these confusing times? Aren't we straying as if through an infinite nothing? Isn't empty space breathing at us? How contemporary is this man? The latest indications are that we are the loneliest, you know, century of all. People, despite all the connections that we make electronically, are lonely, deeply lonely, disoriented. There's no compass to guide us. And finally, Nietzsche refuses to admit defeat. You know, people think he's defeatist. He learned through Schopenhauer not to be a nihilist. He learned from every person that he studied what he didn't dispel them altogether. He took what was good, but he dispensed with what was not so good. And he's not going to fall into nihilism. Regardless of the odds that seem to be stacked against us, he says it is strange then that in the face of inevitable mutual defeat, the irreparable and ultimate defeat of understanding, which life will never allow to tame, is that not true? And for which life will always remain insurmountable, alien even, and the inevitable defeat of action, which will never succeed in ordering the world, which would pacify the longing for order. We talk about the international order. You've heard that a lot, haven't you, on the news? What order? I want to respect international order, just you respect my order more than anyone else's order, you know. For structure, for stability, inscribed in every action, is it strange that tasting the bitterness of the defeat on their lips, life and Zarathustra should look at each other and gaze on the green meadow over which the cool evening is running just then and weep together? Is it strange then that exactly then, we could add, in that moment, in that significant moment, that life was dearer to me than all my wisdom ever was? Isn't that beautiful? But it comes with the caveat that we have to be real. We have to be real. If we pretend, you know, and I was telling the story to the O'Connor people on Sunday that, you know, I said, look, if I wasn't saying what was real, I would hand in my resignation tomorrow to the principal. And I had a table of atheists in year 8, you know, who I discovered were atheists in year 7. And, you know, I said, how many atheists do we have here? And the first lesson they'd ever heard from me when their parents were investigating on sending their children to Radford. I discovered who they were. And they always sat together. And then when I'd said this, one of the boys, you know, the leaders, he beckoned to me and I came over to him and I said, yes. He said, when are you going to resign? And I said, never. Never. So, finally, you remember, we finished the evening with a brief introduction to what we shall now devote the rest of our time to, and I'm conscious of time. We're allowing a bit of leeway tonight because of the inclemency of the evening, which is another way of saying it's dark and people had to find their way here. That this extraordinary admission on Nietzsche's part of a profound identification with Christ. All right? So I read you the German, which I won't read you tonight. But this is fundamentally what he's saying. He's saying this in his book called Ecce Homo, which is Behold the Man, which is what Pilate says to the crowd, the baying crowd, baying for his blood, says, Behold the Man. In German, by the way, it is way up, As you look at this man, weigh up what you're looking at. Don't give it a passing glance. Make up your mind about me. I'm identified with Christ. I am the man. What will you do with me when I call myself the Antichrist? What will you do? Did you not read the subtitle of that title? My work is finished. The re-evaluation of all things. Because he predicted a time would come when we would go through the greatest crisis of the re-evaluation of values ever. And aren't we going through it right now? He foresaw that. He really did. He says, Ecce Homo is who I am. I am the man. My title aims to make that point. I am identified with Christ on Pilate's judgment day. And when you behold me in the persona of the Christ, I am asking you to cast a long, lingering look, which is what betrachten means in German, a long, lingering look, not a passing glance, but make of it a considered, rational, intelligent observation, born of curiosity, there's the child, as to why I am so identified. He could have said the same about why I call myself the Antichrist. The whole exercise of this book, he says, is intended to enlighten and to startle. I suspect, understood, it is going to be all too successful. And he wasn't wrong. So tonight, I intend to confront the charge with which Nietzsche is often labelled, that he is an apostate because he denies Christ. The charge takes me back to the core of my PhD business, the title of which at Bangor University's School of History, Law and Social Sciences, Philosophy and Religion, was A Case of Misplaced Resentment, Dionysus and the Crucified. So before I venture into that territory, I have a treat for you. David Bowie, as you've never seen him, playing Pilate, faced by Christ. And I thought, I'm going to start with this, I'm going to finish with this tonight, and by the time we've got through this, in case we can't get through all of this will be your material, nothing will be lost. We will then discuss it. So I now hand over to Heather, who says that because we're on a different technical material here, because of the clothing store next door, people thought that I was going to do a Nietzsche lecture in amongst the clothes and appear like the, you know, what do they call that funny thing? They appear and, hello, the Inquisition, that's right. Thank you, Heather. Are we ready? Thank you.
So you are the king of the Jews.
King's you.
Well, you are Jesus of Nazareth, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Well, that's what they're saying. You are the king, the Messiah. It's also said that you do miracles. Is this a good magic or bad magic? Could we have some kind of demonstration? I mean, can you do a trick for me now, sir?
No. I'm not a trained animal. I'm not a magician.
Well, that's disappointing. This means that you're just another Jewish politician. Do you want to know something? You're more dangerous than the zealots. Do you know that? Say something. You had better say something. All right. Tell me what you tell people on the streets.
Yes.
Yes.
The prophet Daniel had a vision. A tall stature with a gold head, silver shoulders. The stomach was bronze, the legs were iron, the feet were clay. A stone was thrown. The clay feet broke, and the statue collapsed.
Yes.
You see, God threw the stone. The stone to me. And around
us, the statue is. So your kingdom, or your world, will replace Rome. Where is it?
My kingdom. It's not here. Not on earth.
Wouldn't be, would it?
You know, it's one thing to want to change the way that people live, but you want to change how they think, how they feel. All I'm saying is that change will happen with love, not with killing. Either way, it's dangerous. It's against Rome. It's against the way the world is. And killing or loving, it's all the same. It simply doesn't matter how you want to change things. We don't want them changed. You do understand what has happened. You had a space for you up on Golgotha. 3,000 skulls there by now. Probably more. God! I do wish you people would go out and count them sometime. Maybe you'd learn a lesson.
I bet you didn't think David Bowie could play that part so well. So that takes us then to the central statement that I want us to come back to at the end as well. And I'm thinking, Heather, given that time is kind of ticking away, I'll probably won't need the second showing. I've got the play in front of me, and I'll come back to that, those words. So this is how Nietzsche discusses his relationship with Christ and the significance of Christ dying on the cross. He says, "This bringer of glad tidings died as he had taught, not to redeem, but to show how one must live. This practice is his legacy to humankind, his behavior before the judges, before the accusers, and all kinds of slander and scorn. His behavior on the cross. He does not resist. He does not defend his right. He takes no step to ward off the worst. On the contrary, he provokes it, and he begs, he suffers, he loves with those, in those who do him evil. Not to resist, not to be angry, not to hold responsible, but to resist not even the evil one, to love him." What we find here is Nietzsche's resolve not to offer false hope, not to offer a resurrected body, because we don't have one. None of us can produce the body of Christ, but rather a legacy which epitomizes the value of authenticity. For it is this ethical value whereby Nietzsche's definitive statement highlights Jesus of Nazareth's integrity. He died as he had taught, rather than any kind of dogma or belief system, but rather a facing of death to show not how one must die, but how one must live. Here also, Jesus' exemplary behavior is not some kind of sacrifice to appease an angry God. It is an offering utterly devoid of resentment, even in the midst of an appalling miscarriage of justice. What we discover is that Jesus Nietzsche believes in, the Jesus of Nazareth's absolute refusal to justify himself, Jesus' determination to ignore his accuser's slander and scorn, Jesus' implacable resolve to discount any physical resistance, Jesus' active, not passive, active acceptance of the suffering to come, and finally and notably, Jesus' strong compassion. He begs, he suffers, he loves with those in those who do him evil. Not to resist, not to be angry, not to hold responsible, but to resist not even the evil one, to love him. The word for compassion in German is Mitleid, and lots of academics get stuck into Nietzsche on this. They basically say Nietzsche has no compassion, which of course is a complete misunderstanding of the way he approaches compassion. And none other than Kafka, Franz Kafka, who wrote the novella Metamorphosis, seizes hold of exactly what Nietzsche is talking about when he says we should be careful about our compassion and where our compassion takes us. On this last observation, some Christian commentators argue that Nietzsche's plunge into madness in the Italian town of Turin, when he attempted to intervene to prevent the beating of a horse, was partly to do with his suppression of compassion of the Christ. But actually, and mostly fittingly, the punishment that an apostate deserves. Franz Kafka knew better. A Jewish writer who I believe was influenced by Nietzsche's writing exposes exactly the kind of Mitleid that Nietzsche urges us to avoid, where in the novella Metamorphosis, Kafka reveals to us a man named Gregor Samsa, so given over to his family and the corporation which he serves as a salesman that he ceases to have a life of his own. That's the sort of compassion he's talking about. It is an altruism, a compassion not just gone feral, but shamelessly exploited, which entraps Gregor, an entrapment embodied in the brilliant extended metaphor of the cockroach, which Kafka deploys so effectively in that story. I don't know whether you know it, but the man wakes up one morning and he's a cockroach. Lest we make too light of that, I remember that when I was in Rwanda and I saw a few very disturbing programs about that while we're in there with students, they justified their killing of the opposite, I won't mention race names, as no better than a cockroach to be crushed underfoot. I now outline the following important contextual insights into how and why Nietzsche speaks of the Christ and Dionysus in the same breath, viewed in the context of ressentiment. So I can see from the way my time is going that I will cut this fairly short, but I will give you the essence, which you can then follow up in your reading. So remember, my thesis was on a case of misplaced resentment, Dionysus and the Crucified. So of course immediately Christian people reading this think, well, what's he on about Dionysus for? That he's a pagan god. Not only that, he's a drunken god. You know, he's the god of tragedy. You know, what are we doing with Dionysus? And they go to town on poor old Nietzsche, saying that Dionysus, who gets torn apart into pieces, is emblematic, a personification of Nietzsche and his scattered brain and sanity. But you see, Nietzsche's Dionysus is a different kind of Dionysus. It is Dionysus Zagreb. There were so many Dionysuses, if you look at the study of it, which Dionysus should we believe in? Well, this one, rather than being an advocate for violence and drunkenness and debauchery, is seen by Nietzsche, or seen by the myth that supports this Dionysus, as a transgressor against the prevailing law of Pentheus and Lycurgus, a Dionysus who acts sovereignly against the law in order to put an end to violence, not to propagate it. So let's get that very clear in our minds. In addition, Nietzsche's Dionysus serves to expose the violence and duplicity of any sacrificial system and its values, highlighting its contingency, partiality, and fragility, classifying this Dionysus, his Dionysus, as an iconoclast, an ascetic gesture designed to humble precisely those in authority who would attempt to justify violence in the name of a god or a greater good. That's powerful, isn't it? Powerful. And so later on, as we come to it, we realize that when Nietzsche calls himself the Antichrist, he is standing with Jesus against that kind of Christ. And if you don't understand what that kind of Christ is, I hope at least at very least, with all this other material having to be passed over, you will understand why Jesus and Nietzsche stand together against that kind of Christ, against that kind of God. And we will never again think of him as gratuitous in his rejection of that kind of Christ and that kind of God. Of course, the guy that really got me going was Professor Giuseppe Funari, who wrote A God Torn to Pieces, The Nietzsche Case. I can remember reading it for the first time in Central Australia, in Alice Springs, and slamming the book down and thinking, this is unconscionable. And it was that book and that thesis that got me deeply involved with Nietzsche, because I realized then that this man has been profoundly misrepresented and misinterpreted. But you know what? That naughty, naughty, naughty man, in his foreword, tucked away in a little sentence, says, in the end, and he actually goes on to say, whatever you remember, I want you to remember this, in the end, Nietzsche was much closer to Christ than many who would claim to be Christians. But having said that in the foreword, he then goes on to say, at the end of the book, I'll make a few more comments about what he does say in the book, and you'll understand why I was so angry, that in the conclusion of the book, he comes out with this salvo, referring to those like Nietzsche, blinded by the mask of their violence, and so unable to see it, they must bend there before the one who was humiliated and trampled by all, meaning Jesus. They must recognize that there alone lies the blame and there alone redemption. But there are those, understood, like Nietzsche, who refuse to do this, who refuse to believe that they too have been forgiven. And so in order to see, to embrace this inaccessible God, they are reduced to madness. So for all of his, you know, lovely statements about Nietzsche here and there, and certainly at the end he sees him as actually being a mystic, would you believe, and it's extraordinary how he manages to take these two totally contradictory perspectives and make them sit together. The thing that really got me angry about that book, I have to say, was that he begins by giving us the medical records of Nietzsche when he went mad in Turin in 1888, when he intervened with the horse being whipped. He gives us the medical records So that before you've even got going into the book, you're already, you know, you're so obsessed with the insane Nietzsche that you cannot see the Nietzsche who produced these amazing pieces of work that have influenced all of philosophy, even if people are reluctant to admit to it. I argue that the Nietzsche project cannot be understood unless we stand with Christ on the day of Pontius Pilate's judgment, provoked by the maddened crowd against him, and understand that he is standing there as well. As Alistair Key indicates, and he's one of the commentators that sees this, he says, it is as if Jesus too is the Antichrist. He stands against this new golden calf, shoulder to shoulder, not one, but two Antichrists standing proud and firm against the church's Christ when their Christ has been misrepresented. Do you know when he's being misrepresented? I'll tell you when he's misrepresented. Have you ever seen Vladimir Putin sitting next to the Patriarch of Moscow? That's when he's being misrepresented. And conversely, in Israel, with Israelis tearing their hair out in desperation, Netanyahu is doing exactly the same thing. He's taking the New Testament, as it were, and the Old Testament versions that we need to stand against. This sanctioning of violence in the name of some moral cause. That's what. Can you see what Nietzsche was getting at? When religion causes us to become unfeeling and violent, then we have cause to question that religion. That's what Jesus was doing. What was he doing? He was unmasking the religion of his day by overturning all the tables. And then by going to the cross, he said, this is where your religion takes you. This is where your stupid faith is taking you. To this kind of insensitivity. And I stand against it. And I'm here as a perpetual memorial that this death that I am offering is your cause and your judgment, but it is for my friends an act of love to unmask you. And that's exactly what I think Nietzsche is doing. Not just unmasking religion, but unmasking anything that wears a mask and isn't true to the reality in front of them. Now, there's a lot of material there that I will have to pass over, and I'm just thinking it is to honour the time of Q&A. You'll be relieved to know you'll be able to read this in the comfort of your lounge chair at home. In a nutshell, my argument is that while Nietzsche sides with Pilate, who he sees acting with integrity, and by the way, Nietzsche got very annoyed with Christians trying to make out that Pilate was somehow complicit with Jesus. And I think there's a lot of historical proof to show that there's probably a little bit of exaggeration going on the Christian side to make Pilate appear to be more understanding about where Jesus stood than he really was. And I can't prove that now because I've had to leave all of that out, but you'll read it when you see it in your armchair sipping away at your sarsaparilla or any other drink that you might be drinking. So we leave that sitting there. There's a very long stretch here where I look at Jean-Luc Marion, who picks the fact that yes, Nietzsche actually is identified with Christ, and I don't like what he's doing, and I think it's ridiculous. You know, he is an atheist, he wants to be an atheist, why is he identifying with Christ? So I see him as having failed to dispense himself of idols. He's made of Christ an idol. Of course, he completely misunderstands that. But when you look at the fine print of all of that, you will understand what I'm saying there. So fortunately, I had the presence of mind to put down the entire text of our little study at the beginning, and so we'll be able to approach it again from this lens. And as I said, you'll need to pull all of these things together, and you've got the gist of how he's identified with Christ. Okay, that's the important thing. And then there's a whole lot of theoretical work that goes into it as well. I suppose I'd like to finish with this. At the end of the day, or at night here, why should any of this concern us? Why should we even be bothered coming out and, you know, wading through all the clothing in the other room, finding ourselves here? Why should we be at home when we could be watching something or sitting back? Does it matter that we do or don't understand Nietzsche? Does it matter how we represent or misrepresent Nietzsche? Does it matter that we dismiss him as a madman, decry him as an apostate, refuse him a seat in the academy of the great philosophers and philologists, and we might add psychologists, who have borrowed shamelessly from him and never acknowledged him truly? Does it matter that we walk away from him, not knowing him, treating him as one, to use his own quaint way of putting it, content ourselves to know him only as a cloud of his true self? The true person that he is, just allowing him to drift across the horizon of our preconceptions and our prejudices, precluding the deep insights he offers us, which may serve us in this urgent time of the most radical revaluation of values that this history has ever had to face. People never see that. Have you ever heard of anyone saying that the subtitle of the Antichrist was the revaluation of all values? Of course not. Because they've just taken a passing look and just joined the baying crowd and condemned him without understanding him. Will we walk away from Nietzsche and call him a liar and deceiver? Or will we join him in, again in his own words, to serve the truth? And at the end of the day, when we have made up our minds, will we at least embrace the perennial challenge he puts before all of us? Is that what you want? That's what he does in the Gay Science, where he talks about the madman. He'll lead you up this path, you know, and then he'll suddenly turn. Sorry, I'm conscious that I'm on camera. He'll suddenly turn and say, well, is that what you really want? Is that what you really think? Should you be thinking it? Should you be going in this direction? Should you be cutting off the sun? Should you not know where is up and down? Is that what you want? We finish as we began by allowing the encounter between Christ and Pontius Pilate to speak to us. So rather than playing it, I'm going to read you the text. And then I'm going to make very few comments, and we will still have a half an hour for Q&A. And as far as I'm concerned, this is an ongoing discussion. You know, we don't have to, you know, kind of get constipation, as it were, by, so to speak. I do apologize to anyone who may just have finished their dinner. No, we're going to take it quietly and steadily. So I'm going to read the encounter again, and then I'm going to make a few comments, some of which I've already made. I was so incensed. So you are the King of the Jews. They're your words. Well, you are Jesus of Nazareth, aren't you? Yes, I am. Well, that's what they're saying. You are the King, the Messiah. It's also said that you do miracles. Is it good magic or bad magic? Can we have some kind of demonstration? I mean, can you do a trick for me now? No, I'm not a trained animal. I'm not a magician. That's disappointing. This means you're just another Jewish politician. Do you want to know something? You're more dangerous than the zealots. Say something. You'd better say something. All right, tell me what you tell people in the streets. Yes? Yes. The prophet Daniel had a vision. A tall statue had a gold head. silver shoulders, the stomach was bronze, the legs were iron, the feet were clay, a stone was thrown. The clay feet broke, the statue collapsed. Yes, you see, God threw the stone. The stone's me and Rome. And Rome is a statue. So your kingdom or your world will replace Rome. Where is it? My kingdom? It's not here. Not on earth. It wouldn't be, would it? He sits with him, by the way. You know, it's one thing to want to change the way people live, but you want to change how they think, how they feel. All I'm saying is, change will happen with love, not with killing. Pilate, either way, it's dangerous. It's against Rome. It's against the way the world is. And killing or loving, it's the same. It simply doesn't matter how you want to change things. We don't want them changed. Silence. Jesus looks at Pilate. Pilate looks at Jesus. Pilate walks away to his previous place of distance. You do understand what has to happen. We have a space for you up on Golgotha. 3,000 skulls up there. By now, probably more. God, I do wish you people would go out and count them sometime. Maybe you'd learn a lesson. No, probably not. What is the lesson for us tonight? What will be the lesson when you read through these copious notes while you're sipping your sarsaparilla or your G&T? I do that, you know, for the sake of the children. Is it to do with, as Jesus said, that we as humans are constantly wearing masks, which he also calls hypocrisy? Is it that we are categorizers, so busy labeling, typecasting, stereotyping, prejudging each other to the point where we can't hear or see each other anymore? To the point where we go around not knowing what we're doing, having to be forgiven all the time, forgiving ourselves for having so stupidly misunderstood, misrepresented, misconceived what is before us? Because neither our values, nor our awareness, nor our understanding, or our moral courage is up to it. Masking and categorizing, categorically denying what is evident to a dispassionate observer, to ourselves, in our better moments. Do we take seriously the distinction Jesus makes between a sign and a miracle, whereby a miracle may be questioned and debated, misrepresented, but a sign is incontrovertible, solid as reality, is solid even when we don't understand it and can't see it with the naked eye, like dark matter and dark energy? The sign of Jonah will be the sign for our generation, as it was when Jesus said, that will be the sign for that generation. Whereby the last message of Jesus of Nazareth is not only, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they are doing, but that change will happen with love, not with killing. Exactly as that beautiful line said in our little replay. That love sits at the center of even all dark matter and dark energy, and will have the last word. That no blood or life offering is required to satisfy an angry God. Just a radical change of mind, that's all that's required. A radical change of mind of justice and kindness and mercy, such as the Ninevites experienced when they changed their mind in sackcloth and ashes, and all their animals, not one of them, had to be destroyed. they too shared the sackcloth and ashes. And do you know that Yom Kippur, they read the entire book of Job to remind themselves that God is too merciful, and that if we forget that God is merciful, then we're in serious trouble. How will Benjamin Netanyahu answer to the book of Jonah when it is read in full at Yom Kippur? Will he run away like the prophet because God is too merciful? What will Vladimir Putin, what will the Patriarch of Moscow, Kirill, leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, say, who sits beside Putin, the one who walks with him, blessing the troops who go out to kill? What will Donald Trump say, who faces 90 charges and more, threatening a bloodbath if he's not elected? The list goes on. The challenges of undergoing, overcoming and becoming, the onus of living an exemplary life, which is how we began, an exemplary life, the one to which Nietzsche summons us, and the one I believe the true Christ and the true God summons us. Not to make distinctions, not to categorize, to meet our Muslim brothers and sisters, to meet our Jewish brothers and sisters, our Hindu brothers and sisters, our all human brothers and sisters, and welcome them as equals. That is what we are called to do, because God is all merciful. So, that's not too bad, is it? That leaves us with 20 minutes. I've left out an enormous amount, and I do apologize. And I do hope that you haven't had, I hope some of that made sense. But I think the essence is, when you look at Nietzsche, do you take a long, lingering look before you throw a stone at him? Because he's the stone. He's the stone, just as Jesus is the stone. To call into question all of our very kind of smug ideas. I'm going to hand over to Sarah now, and we might just open it up for questions, if that's all right, and you might have questions of your own, I think. Thank you, Sarah.